Blog Talk Radio.
That is the one and only Pancho Sanchez. The name of the cut was Watermelon Man. From, you might know from the movie. Some of you old school people like myself, and even older school like my mom. My name is Eric Payne. I am the co-host, and I am the son on this show, which is the K. Thompson Live Show. And you are the who?
K. Thompson, I'm the host of the show, and you are the co-host. And you are the son.
That's right.
We have an exciting show today, Erica. So we really do. You know, we're going to be talking to Richard Wesley, who is a children's screenwriter and speaker and does a lot of things and has done a lot of things. And sometimes what he has done, sometimes what he has done, is just distracted for a minute. He was affiliated with the New Mafia Theater in Harlem, which I know well. And also Joseph Pack, with his first play, and I think that was the Black Tenor or something, the Black Terror or something. I forget about that. Uptown Saturday Night, and that featured Bill Cosby, Richard Pryor, Cliff Wilson, Paul McKellar, and Let's Do It Again, and a number of other things. And we're expecting to talk to him tonight. And also the second part of the show, we're going to be talking to Larry Hazard has been reappointed boxing commissioner mm-hmm. by Governor Chris Christie. He was, you know, he left that title.
Right.
For instance, they took it away from him years ago. It was an unjust decision to make. Mm-hmm. But now, this new governor, reinstated him to being the boxing commissioner of the state of New Jersey. And as you know, New Jersey was quite a mecca for boxing at one particular time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so... we're going to be talking to him.
Well, we have a caller. Call back, caller. Your call was dropped just as I was getting ready to open your mic. That might be Wayne or the 862 number, so it might even be Richard or Mr. Hazard. And as you were saying, Ma, first off, Mr. Larry Hazard is a legendary boxing referee and has been in some has refereed some legendary fights and was always if you watch some fights that he refereed, you can tell that he kept the order and decorum in the ring and always kept a certain level of professionalism and respect. And that's what you always saw when you saw Larry Hazard in the ring, refereeing the ring. And we know about the great Richard Wesley, extraordinary script writer, screenwriter, playwright. Uptown Saturday Night, Let's Do It Again, was a piece of the action. I don't know, Richard, if that was I'm looking on your IMDb. I'm looking on your IMDb right now, and I don't know the piece of the action if you wrote that, but that was probably the third installment of those Uptown Saturday Night and Let's Do It Again movies. Fast Forward was a screenplay. Native Son, you wrote the screenplay. So we look forward to talking to the great and fantastic Richard Wesley. But you have an article in the Hot Topics and Current News that you want to talk about.
Yeah, that I want to talk about while we're waiting for Richard, and maybe we better even give him a ring, you know, so just in case. But anyway, we'll get to that. And by the way, I have an article here that I was reading, and it's really, really unnerving. And it is written by a professor at Rutgers University, and her name is Khadija Cosley White. She's an Indian assistant professor at the Department of Journalism and Media Studies at Rutgers University down in New Brunswick. And she has written an article. The title is Why Are Black Girls Being Ignored? And I thought I had to deal with this, and I'm going to deal with it on a more of an in-depth label when we have her on the air. But I just want to read part of it to you, you know, and... this was in the Star Ledger a couple days ago, Why Are Black Girls Being Ignored? And she says here that last month, the African American Policy Forum released a report on the treatment of black girls in schools. According to their research, black girls are suspended six more times than their white peers. while black boys are only suspended 3 times more than white males. Interesting, right? And this is disproportionately suffer under excessive disciplinary measures in schools. And she said that one story details a teacher hitting an asthmatic and diabetic student while she's not at all in class. And then in Alabama, an 8-year-old girl is arrested for acting out in class. Another girl described police officers writing tickets for tardiness that led to bench warrants for her arrest. And while black girls around the country are struggling in these kinds of conditions, they continue to be ignored or neglected at every level. So President Barack Obama himself made waves when he issued support for a nationwide initiative that targets black boys only, leaving their female counterparts by the wayside. And she says in this article that as she read the stories of these girls, she thought about her own childhood, and she mentioned a few incidents. She said she recalled various moments that nearly threw her off her path. She said there was a time that she was suspended and kicked out of the school play for not standing against a wall long enough. And she said she was also sent to a principal's office for not pledging allegiance to the flag, for not walking down the stairs correctly, speaking out of turn, quietly sitting still and ignoring my teacher out of frustration. So she was really, some of our young black females are really picked on in school, and they don't really talk about it.
Let's get, I think we have Wayne, our other co-host, Mr. Wayne Gilman, on the line. Wayne.
Hi, good evening, folks.
Hi, Wayne.
How are you? I'm sorry, I'm missing it. I'm getting in here a little late, but I finally made it.
Good, we're glad. Everything go okay?
Yeah, the weather over here has been, unbelievable. I don't want to take away from the subject, but, it's just I just hope this storm that's coming tonight is the last one for the season.
Right. Let's get to the weather in a second, Wayne, and continue on about this subject matter. Did you get a chance to hear what my mom was talking about?
About the young people.
Yeah, I tell you, I mean, I take my hat off to anyone who can teach and really have the satisfaction and patience to understand, what that exercise is all about. It's not easy. I did it for a little while with young people in the South Bronx, and it was really tough to make an adjustment. It's just so funny. I ran into a friend of mine today at the bank, and he lost his job at CNBC around the same time that a lot of these media houses were, realigning for the recession back in 2007 and 2008. He went back to school, got a master's degree, started teaching through a wonderful program that he was able to get involved in with Columbia University, in which he was given free tuition in exchanging for teaching for 3 years in the inner city. And, it's funny when you make the transition, like your mom, well, she was a teacher before she got into broadcasting. I'm hoping I'm telling the story right. But, it's one thing to have been in a career and pursue education. But when you see the difficulties that a lot of these young people go through, after being in the private sector doing other things, it's just amazing. I mean, you read stories, and some of the stuff that Kay, you were just talking about, is appalling. I mean, it should not even be. But, it's a game changer once you get there, and you have to prepare yourself to be of the mindset, primarily someone who is patient, to handle some of the challenges that you face with young folks, because not everyone is brought up the way that, you raised your children, Kay, or even my parents, for that matter, I had to go ahead. I'm sorry. No, I was just going to say, I got to the point where, I just had to, segue. As soon as I felt a comfortable moment just to move out of that arena, I did, because, it was just too much of a challenge for me. And I applaud a lot of people, particularly those people who are dealing with young folks who are coming out of elementary, going into the middle school. And that particular period in itself just seems like, you know, their minds are beginning to take shape, and a lot of them feel like they know it all, you know? So, yeah, you know, but it's a challenge. It's quite a challenge.
It's also mutual respect and also understanding what the kids are going through. And I would say that you have to have a sense of humor, you know, when you talk to, you know, certain people, you know, especially young girls. But I'm going to get back to this article. As a matter of fact, I'm trying to find the assistant professor at Rutgers. Now, I left a message down at Rutgers University, and I will get to it. I have so much more to talk about this. I went through a lot of this myself, and it's going to be really very interesting to hear what he has to say also. And right now, I think we can go to another call, and we're going to see if this is Larry Hazard or, you know, is it Larry Hazard? Larry, are you there? Hello, Larry Hazard?
No, it's Cynthia Halliday. It's Cynthia Halliday.
Cynthia, hi. How are you?
Hi. I'm just fine. How are you?
Cynthia Halliday, jazz singer. I didn't expect it. It sounds like you've been talking to Angelo Elevate.
Good me?
It sounds like you've been talking to Angelo Elevate. Yeah. You know, I had told him that I was going to be talking to you. And I'm going to keep you on the first 10 minutes. But did you ever experience, you're a jazz singer. You're fantastic, by the way. And you have been.
Thank you so much.
Well, you know, I know. You know, you have been down at Vonda's restaurant, Deuce Southern Table. You did a few appearances at B.B. King. You've been all over the world. You've been in Russia, which I found interesting. We'll go over that at another time. But how are you doing?
I'm doing just fine.
Well,
you know, just putting one foot in front of the other with this crazy weather that we have. But musically, it's just great.
Yeah. Well, where are you appearing next?
I have a show coming up tomorrow, as a matter of fact, at a Smoke Jazz and Supper Club, which is in New York on Broadway between 105th and 106th Street. And three shows, 7, 9, 30, and 11, I believe. And I'll be performing my new show, which is called Lady Swings the Blues, a combination of jazz favorites and some good old blues.
Well,
After that, I'm coming to Jersey.
Yeah.
Well, I'm finally getting to Jersey again. I wanted to get my Jersey shout out. I'll be at Trumpets on March 14th.
Is that down in
Trumpets in Montclair, New Jersey?
Oh, yeah. Okay, not before. Yeah. And when is that going to be, Cynthia?
March 14th.
March 14th at Trumpets in Montclair, right?
That's right. Two shows, 8 and 10 o'clock.
8 and 10 o'clock.
Yes, I love Trumpets. Thank goodness for Trumpets.
I know, they have some good
You know, so many of the jazz clubs. Yeah, so many of the clubs have just gone away over the years, and Trumpets has been, you know, the little engine that could in terms of continuing to support live music, which for me is such a pleasure.
Yeah. And it's always such a cozy atmosphere when you're able to do a small club, I would imagine. That's what somebody told me one time, a jazz thing. I forget who it was. But they really enjoyed being able to connect with the audience, you know, on a very personal level. And so you were over there at B.B. King,
That's
right?
True.
Yeah, how was that?
Yes, wonderful. You know, it's just the thrill of playing at such a well-known club. I was actually in Lucille's, which is the they call it the Lucille's Grill, one of the rooms within the larger B.B. King Club, but it's wonderful. You know, the ambiance is right. You've got plenty of tourists to come, you know, to enjoy the show, and it was just an honor for me to be there.
Yeah. Wow. Anyway, listen, I will talk to you again, you know, very soon. So thank you for calling in, and I will call you right after the show, as a matter of fact. Okay?
Okay. Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Okay. And that was Cynthia Holliday calling in. I did not have her on my schedule. I think I'm going to mix up with them. I'll have to talk to Angela about that. But anyway, Eric, Wayne, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. She sounded very interesting. I wanted to actually ask her. You know, what she said is very true. A lot of these clubs are just fading into the sunset, and you know, it's so hard to catch these acts in a small, intimate setting. And I was just wondering what her thoughts were in terms of why that is going on. You know, because there is still an audience, a demographic that appreciates that. And,
are these
clubs going out of existence
or something, or what?
I'm sorry,
what'd
you say?
I said, are these small clubs going out of existence or what?
Yeah, it seems that way. I was listening to a program on one of the public stations recently, and that was the subject of discussion, that there are a lot of people who would like to make appearances at places, and for some reason they're not getting the support. Like, I think the Village Vanguard in the city here in Manhattan is like probably one of the few places that are still around, but one time there was talk of that closing. And, of course, everybody knows B.B. King's. Recently, Darlene Love was there during the Christmas holidays, and she had a great show. But, you know, usually you got to go into these big arenas to catch some of these acts. And if they can't draw that crowd, you know, it's just unfortunate. I'm glad she mentioned the place in Montclair there, Trumpets. I had gone there once. It's a beautiful spot. And, you know, they really need to support these institutions because we have a lot of talent in our community, in all communities, and there should be, a venue for people to go to and support and give support without paying an outrageous figure to see a show, because that's the other thing.
But, you know, this New Jersey Performing Arts Center has a lot of different programs. I wish you could see their roster, you know, of performers, because they have a whole lot of different things, and it's going on all the time. Even a lot of community groups, you know, have their affairs down there. So, and events. So it's a really big deal thing. As a matter of fact, when we are able to talk to Richard Wesley, you know, he recently, you know, did a presentation down there in the Parsonette Room of Medicine. So, you can participate in a lot of conversation, good conversation, about different things. And so we're going to be keeping people up to date. But, you know, Wayne, with Larry Hardesty, not Larry Hardesty, Larry Hagen's Hazard. I'm going to ask
Certain Larry would like that.
But I'm going to ask him about the days when New Jersey was like a boxing mecca, especially down there in Atlantic City.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I remember when Gus and I went to a boxing match down there, and Tyson was there, but he wasn't fighting. But a person walked in who got the biggest applause, and people were yelling and whatnot. And that was one of my first, well, maybe it was the second or third time at a boxing match. But it was Tony, what is it for the name of that show? The Sopranos. And should have been applause. And it was really kind of funny, you know. But anyway, Larry, I was very interested in talking to Larry because he has represented some of the most famous boxers in the world, including Muhammad Ali.
But until we do.
Right, right.
Let's talk about the hot topics that we have there. Wayne, you know, I want to get into the politics. I was wondering what you guys think. First off, you know, some of the hot topics we have in the news, yet another African-American has been shot by police in Los Angeles earlier this week, a homeless guy, and quite interestingly enough, the media and the police released other records saying he was a bank robber who was homeless and stole a guy's ID, and you know, here comes the character assassination of this guy who got shot by a black cop, But the thing is, if anybody has seen, and I'm sure a lot of people by now have seen the video, or a good number of people have, you know, there are about five or six cops that was fighting this guy. None of them could hold on to him, which is the funny thing, which is always remarkable because, you know, they always come with such overwhelming force, but they seem not to be able to handle people and they have to use deadly force. And my question would be, how do you guys get the job if you can't take down a person? You're supposed to be a police officer. You should be able to take down the person without immediately going to excessive or deadly force. I understand that you want to be protected, and in the scuffling, somebody's gun could get ripped off. But, you know, after experiencing this all my life, I'm sure all your life, all my mom's life, all every black person's life in the United States, it gets to be a little tired after a while that we constantly have to put up with this. If you talk about today, the Justice Department found that they couldn't indict Darren Wilson, and everybody knew that. But I think it's high time that we need to change our slogans from hands up, and we need to get rid of all these passive slogans instead of hands up and I can't breathe. We need to do like Sarah Palin did and say, talk about being reloaded, get locked and loaded. Black people need to start forming their own militias. When you have a tyrannical government like the city of Ferguson, maybe they should take a lesson out of the great American like Clive and Bundy out there in the out west when they tried to make him pay taxes for the years that he was, and he and other militia people, Americans who thought that the government was being out of line, stood up with him. So let's get with it, Ferguson. Take a message out of the Clive and Bundy's playbook and stand up. Develop your own forces to protect yourself when the government is oppressive. That's your right in the Constitution, from what I understand, that the citizenry has a right to form a militia when the government is being tyrannical. So I just wanted to go on that little rant.
Yeah.
You guys let me know what you think about that.
No, that rant is fine.
Well, I agree. I mean, I hate to say it, but, I mean, the thing is that until you see masses of black folks signing up with the NRA, you know, this level of intimidation and quiet protest, although that was the mindset of the late, great Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, I mean, it's unfortunate. You know, how many lives must be lost just to get a point across? And as we see with the Justice Department's investigation of Ferguson, you know, that a lot of this is just about making money. They could care less about the populace and who they take out. You know, it just hurts to see this happen all the time, just as much as it hurts me to see, you know, black on black or Latino on black, Latino on Latino. You know, I mean, it just bothers me. You don't want to get into this whole gun culture, but you kind of wonder every time you turn on the news, is something going on here, there, and everywhere? When does it come to an end? When, you know, is he afraid to walk out your house?
You know, one thing, it's a good thing that Eric Holder, you know, went to Ferguson in Missouri because of the report that came back. I was being very careful in watching this whole thing. And they were saying that 90%, you know, of the people, the police department in Ferguson, you know, had racist views or they practiced racism. And
exactly.
90% of the cases involving, you know, blacks, you know, they were just, everybody was being arrested. And there is the culture of racism. Finally, you know, it took a black attorney general to bring that out. And thank goodness Obama, you know, had him as attorney general, or we would not have heard that. We all knew that because it's been going on for quite a while. Okay? If you look, you know, on television or radio and listen to what Eric Holder has to say, because he was on CNN and MSNBC, and he was breaking down the figures and the percents of, you know, the police, you know, doing dastardly things to, you know, people in the black community. In fact, you saw that with the L.A. thing, you know, shooting that guy. A whole lot of people shooting him. How many times? Come on.
I mean, why not tase somebody in that condition? I mean, I just, you know, to me, there's so many people who have been let go of institutions, and they're walking the streets just like that poor gentleman in L.A., and they fall prey to innocent actions like that, and there are ways of getting around that. These people need to be in an area where they're quarantined and getting the kind of help that they can get. But the whole racism factor, it's alive and well. Look at Benjamin Netanyahu coming here from Israel, having a meeting with members of Congress, you know, something that the White House was not even involved in, but the Republican Party wants to say, you know, in a subtle way, show who's boss, you know, and it just blows me away every time I see, you know, Boehner up there, you know, conducting, trying to keep his party in charge with what's going on, but it still adds to that split. It's like no matter who the hell is president, it doesn't matter, you know.
He insulted President Obama. There's no doubt about it. That's exactly what he did, by going over his head to have this president of another country come in without checking with the White House. Who does that?
Exactly.
Who has ever done that? You know, and he's looking like a complete idiot, like a mad rat who swallowed the cat or something. You know, this is what he did. Well, I think it's going to backfire on him because of the fact that, you know, God does not like ugly.
I had wished the Congressional Black Caucus held to its guns and just, you know, walked out in unison. But, you know, the deal is that lobby is so big, you know, they don't want to have any confusion showing that, you know, that they're anti-Semitic or what have you. I understand,
Hold on, Wayne. There are a couple of members of the caucus that did boycott Prime Minister Netanyahu's thing. Now, maybe the caucus didn't do it as a whole, but there were some members that boycotted his thing. So, you know, before you go into
the... I wasn't aware. I mean, the thing is, I knew that there was a decision at one point that they were staying out in unison, and then next thing you know, you saw Charlie, we saw in Brooklyn there, Yvette Clark, if I'm not mistaken, I think she attended. I could be wrong. I don't know. I saw the camera pan. I wasn't really on it the way I should have, but I knew that there was an uproar that the caucus had made the decision to boycott it.
Yeah, well, I wasn't as familiar with that bit of news, but I know that there, and as you say, that those Black caucus members were there. Let's also point out that Nancy Pelosi was in the House, Harry Reid, some of those very other Democrats. Let's not focus in on the only Black people we got there speaking up for us, buddy. So
No, I understand what you're saying. I mean, and the thing is, and even Pelosi walked out. I mean, she understood what was going on. There was a slap in this man's face. We have a sitting president, regardless of what color he is.
I believe it's despicable. I just want to get somebody else in. I think we have may have Mr. Larry Hazard in there, and I'm certain that he has some opinions on this topic that we're talking. Is that you, Commissioner?
Yes, sir.
How are you, sir? Mr. Hazard, this is Eric Payne here with my mom again and Wayne Gilman. It's a pleasure to have our New Jersey State Boxing Commissioner, Mr. Larry Hazard, once again on the K-Tops Live Show. How are you, sir?
Okay, brother. It's my pleasure to be here.
Yeah, Larry.
My pleasure to be on once again.
Wayne, say hello to Larry Hazard.
Hi, good evening, Commissioner. How are you? It's an honor.
I'm fine, sir. How are you?
I guess okay. It's been quite a while since I've had a chance to talk to you. You know, we go back to the old days on WLIB.
Yeah, well, we're still around. We're still around going strong.
That's
you know,
good to hear.
Good to hear your voice. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Hazard, what do you, before we get off into the boxing and the upcoming, you know, I guess the biggest announcement is Floyd and Manny Pacquiao, but what do you think about what we were just talking about? I know that you're a brilliant man, and I know that you have some insight about, you know, some of the politics and what we're just talking about this Israeli prime minister coming over and in a kind of a disrespectful way, I think, that they kind of upstaged the president or disrespected the president.
Well, I kind of came in on the tail end, but it's just what we're used to seeing. You know, this president, our president, President Obama, you know, is just another example of the disrespect that's not only shown to our president, but shown to Black people as a whole in general. You know, they don't respect us. Here's a man who holds the highest office in the free world. And yet, you know, they had the audacity to invite a foreign leader to this country, you know, and without him being, you know, brought in on the conversation, without him being a part of it. So it's just something that we should be used to by now. You know, being that he's president, I guess, you know, we felt that, you know, they wouldn't reach or they wouldn't go that low, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to some people, and it's just something that we have to be cognizant of, we have to understand, and we have to live with. But me personally, I'm very pessimistic about the situation when it comes to whether it be politics or whether it be just, you know, race relations in general. You know, we still have a long way to go. And any time we can ascend to the highest office in the land, and it got worse, you know. Yeah. It's like, you know, we don't care even if you become president of this country, we will still show you, you know, how disrespectful we can be and how we really feel, you know, about African Americans. So that's the way I see it.
Right, and I kind of agree with you. It's unfortunate to be pessimistic about it, but it is what it is. And let me kind of
it is what it is.
Yeah, let me kind of move that into the boxing realm. What I mean, and I know that you probably witnessed, I'm sure, somewhere along the line, the racism within the fight game. What are your perspectives along those lines, and the race relationships and the racism that might have been around during the course of your career?
Well, you know, it's not quite as glaring in boxing as it is even in some sports. You know, there's a way that racism kind of hides its head a little bit in sports, professional sports, but in boxing, you know, it's there also. You know, in the officiating, you know, in the way that some of the fighters are treated. And, you know, I mean, you've heard some of the old stories. They're all too common. You know, we make the big money, but it's a sport where until Don King came along, you know, there were very few African Americans who occupied, you know, positions of that level outside of the you know, the arena itself, outside of competing, you know. But once again, you know, even today, we seem to always break through, you know, at some point. Today, there's a fellow by the name of Al Haymon who has taken Don King's place. There's always one, you know. And of course, on the administrative side, I'm one of the very few African Americans who sit on top of a commission who regulate the sport, you know, on a statewide basis. So it's there, but we still, you know, we survive, and we still emerge victorious, you know, as champions in whatever field we occupy in the sport, because we, you know, we're true fighters.
You know, Larry, I'd like to ask you something. Now, you were reappointed by Governor Chris Christie. How did that happen?
Well, you know, it's kind of a long story, you know, but it just happened. You know, there seemed to be an interest, you know, in bringing me back at the political level, and I was kind of surprised. You know, when I left, I was surprised, and I was surprised when they brought me back. But I think there was some politics involved in it, you know, in the background. Some local politics as well as some statewide politics. Wow. So I got back, and I'm very happy about it, you know.
You know, I do tell people also that you were a teacher, and you were Donald Payne's, my brother-in-law, and Eric's uncle. I think he was one of your teachers, right?
I was a teacher. I was a school principal in Newark. Donald Payne was one of the childhood idols. Mm-hmm. And I had the greatest respect for Donald Payne. Donald Payne was my ninth grade English teacher at Robert Treat Junior High School. Now, the thing that was missing, I was at, and you know, I still refer to him as Mr. Payne to this day, you know, and I'm a grandfather, and I always felt strange, even when I talked to him, I would refer to him as Mr. Payne. I never called him Donald, you know, but in 1959, I was a ninth grade student at Robert Treat. It was a junior high school then. That's the science high school now.
Yeah.
That site was science high school. Well, that was Robert Treat. Used to sit on that corner, and he was an English teacher there. But he was there before I got there, because he also was my brother, who was there a year before me. So in 58, he must have came there sometime around 57 or 58, and he was he taught English, and.
Mm-hmm.
Man, everybody loved Donald Payne. I mean, Donald Payne and I was close to him for years, even when I was boxing. And I love to tell the story. This guy was very unique. You know, he was all the girls liked him. He was cool. You know what I mean? And he'd come out on the playground. He'd come out on the playground and play basketball with the guys. You know what I mean? He was young. He was real young then, you know. Dressed nice, he was sharp, and then he, you know, when school was over, you know, I grew up on 15th and Morris Avenue, which was the old Third Ward, which is a Central Ward now, and Robert Treat was on Norfolk Street and 13th Avenue, and he would come out, and he would then go down on Jones Street. There was a YMCA on Jones Street right at the fork, right at the T, where 14th Avenue ran into Jones Street, and he ran the YMCA. So he was a fixture. Donald Payne was a fixture in our neighborhood. Now, you know, that was strange back then, because we didn't have a lot of black, you know, teachers at that time. And so to have a teacher who looked like us, and then when school was over, he was right there in the neighborhood, you know, where we were, you know, that was strange then. And, you know, he was just a wonderful person. And I always like to tell the story about Donald Payne. Donald used to, when I was boxing, amateur, you know, you had to be 16 years old. You were supposed to be 16 to compete in the AAU, amateurs. Well, I used my brother's birth certificate. I was 14. I put my age up. And I was fighting. I was competing in the Golden Gloves out in Elizabeth. Donald and his brother, Eric's father, Bill Payne. Bill Payne, they used to come to the fights. They used to come out to Elizabeth. And Donald used to come out, and he used to see me fight. And he knew that I was too young to be competing. But, you know, I did okay for myself. So what he would do anytime I would act out of character in school, he would ease over to me, and he would say, and he would threaten to turn me in, you know, he would threaten to turn me in, and I'd straighten up, man, and he used that. He kept that over my head. Anytime I would act out of character, he would kind of tell me, say, you know, I know you're not supposed to be competing, you know, if you don't straighten up, I'll put an end to that, you know what I mean? And so I'd straighten up in a hurry, man. You know, I always, him and I in later years, we would laugh about that when I would see him. And I used to tell him, man, you remember how you used to hold that over? He said, well, it did the trick, Larry. Look at you now. You know what I mean? So, you know, man, he was quite a guy, man. But the one thing that I kind of resented, well, not resented, but I thought that they left out when at his funeral, you know, they were talking about his background. I said, oh, they forgot about Robert Treat. You know what I mean? They didn't mention that he had taught. They talked about Southside, you know, because I know he had taught school at Southside. So I said, well, here's a man who'd done so much and was so much an asset in the black community. that, you know, sometimes you can't get everything. And, you know, when people have done so much, man, you forget some of the things that they've done. But there were so many young guys like myself and girls who owe so much to Donald Payne coming up. And I know I can really speak for myself, man. He was quite a guy. And they just don't make them like that anymore.
Yeah, Larry, also, people, you know, owe you a lot also. Now, I have a bone to pick with you, and I think you know what I'm going to be talking about. You are also, you've also taught martial arts, okay? Now,
oh, yeah, many years.
I remember going to your gym one day and seeing the video of me jumping rope when I interviewed Vi Higginson and his son Roku. And here you are. You had me jumping rope. Now, was that to encourage the boxers to jump rope? I love that video.
That's the video. I don't know where that video is now. I don't know.
I'd love
I got
to
so
see
much.
It.
No, she was pretty good. She was pretty good, Eric.
Yeah, they after doing the double dutch with the sisters there, I guess, you know, they got some skills on the double. Mr. Hatcher, let me ask you, well, my mom just told me to ask you about Muhammad Ali, and that's a whole hour thing by itself, but since you brought it up, I'm going to bring it up, because when we were talking about a little while ago about, you know, the racism and black people coming up, you know, when I was a boy, you know, when Muhammad Ali first came on the scene, or resurfaced on the scene, really, which I should say, during my awareness, and as I became older, first I didn't like this guy, Cassius Clay, because he talked a lot of trash. And living in the suburban area of Maplewood, being one of the few blacks, you know, was a challenge. But as time went on and I got older, I became a Muhammad Ali fan. I was a Joe Frazier fan in that first one. I became a Muhammad Ali fan because he taught me to be proud of who I was. And this black man who said, when Muhammad Ali said you made up a rhyme and said you were going down in a certain round, you could bet your bottom dollar, as Don King used to say, that person was going down. I mean, I remember there was just fights where Muhammad Ali said he's going down in the third round, and that person was getting knocked out in the third round. But it wasn't only that. It was how he carried himself as a black man.
He went down his
as he carried himself as a black man. And that's what gave me the pride in myself in being in this suburban community where I was one of the few black ones, but it was Muhammad Ali that taught us to have, at least taught me to have that pride and that confidence. And it seemed that I guess my question to you is that when he came on the scene, there was kind of a breakthrough for black people in the boxing game. I mean, is that accurate in my, or is that just me being misinformed and thinking that? How do you feel about his impact for African Americans in the fight game?
Oh, well, you know, I think it goes without saying. You know, he made a great impact when he came on the scene. And what made him so great was exactly what you said. You know, what he said he was going to do, he did. And, you know, he kind of, with the boldness and the courage that he displayed, he gave all of us a great sense of pride and confidence in ourselves that we too could achieve great things, not only in the boxing ring but outside of sports and athletics. Because what Ali was a great example that kind of transcended the sport of boxing. And I used to tell Joe Frazier, who really, really never forgave Ali, you know, for some of the things that he said about him, you know, before they fight. But I used to tell Joe and I were very good friends, and I used to tell Joe, you know, you have to understand that Ali is very special, and that he's more than a fighter. And, you know, people love you just as much, but they love him in a different way sometimes because of who he is and what he has attained, especially his stance that he took on the war. So he became that great political figure as well as that athletic figure. So that set him above and apart from everyone else in any sport.
Right.
See, and
yeah,
then
I would have to agree.
Looked,
I mean, I'm sorry, Commissioner. Go ahead.
You know what I mean, Eric? And being that he looked at he looked like us, that gave us a greater sense of empowerment also, deep within.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it made us feel better about ourselves. And he made up for years and years of, you know, for African Americans in terms of how we viewed ourselves. Here's a man who could be this bold and be that successful. So
If I might, I just want to interject and forgive me for doing so, but, I remember, and I'm not old enough to say that I witnessed any of the Joe Louis fights. I vaguely remember Sugar Ray Robinson. You know, every black man who had that title at some point, you know, left their mark on our society because, I mean, they drew just as many black fans and fans on the whole because of their dynamic and their skill in boxing. But as you said, I think the thing that really made the difference with Ali was, you know, him converting to Islam and the fact that he protested the Vietnam War and he stayed in the prime of his boxing career, those years, that he stood out and he came back. And the fact that, you know, Parkinson's has silenced him now. I mean, it's just unfortunate that, you know, just before it got to the point where it is now where you don't see or hear anything about him, that they honored him while he had his faculties. I'll never forget, and if you ever get a chance, Eric, to Google the Billy Crystal tribute to Muhammad Ali one night. And it was just amazing to sit there and think, you know, what this man accomplished at the age of 50. I think it was on his 50th birthday because he was just beginning to decline. They had diagnosed him and they found out he was suffering from Parkinson's. But all those other boxes paled in comparison. I mean, with all due respect to Joe Frazier, you know, I mean, he was good at what he did. He beat up on Ali once, but, you know, no one paid the price the way Muhammad did for what he went through.
Well, you know,
he showed that extra level of courage that no other fighter. It just happened to be a fighter, okay? And he happened to be a fighter that did it. And when he converted to the Muslims, you know, back then, to do that was very bold.
Yeah, right.
Very, very bold, almost unheard of.
Right.
And he was able to do it and be successful at fighting and still espouse his doctrine of being a black man. And actually, the doctrine that he had adopted was a separatist type of doctrine, you know.
Right.
So he was really being very, very bold. You know what
Yeah, because back then the Nation of Islam didn't want whites involved in all that.
That's right.
Right.
You know, referring to white people as the devil and all
devil.
That kind of stuff.
Exactly.
He came under that old doctrine.
That was really
unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But listen,
I tell you.
I have a request, Larry. Who's going to win between Pacquiao and Mayweather?
Well, I knew that question was going to come. Everybody, I can't get away from that question. And you know, I've been trying to avoid it, but I have to preface my answer with, don't bet the ranch on whatever I say, okay? But I'm going to tell you like this. I've been prognosticating on these big fights for many years, and I haven't been wrong often. Donald Trump used to ease up to me in Atlantic City at the big fights, and he'd say, "Who's going to win this, Larry?" And I would tell him, and it would come out just the way I told him, you know.
Uh-huh.
Now, here's my spin on this. I see Pacquiao winning a close decision, and then all of the Mayweather fans are going to claim that he got robbed, okay? I've been in this business a long time, I'm telling you.
Whoa.
And please, let me tell you something. This is they are pulling highway robbery on this fight. Do you know that ringside costs you $5,000? The cheapest,
what?
They tell me the cheapest ticket in the house is $2,000, I think, somewhere between $1,500 and $2,000. Okay, and it's almost sold out. Pay per view is probably going to cost anywhere from $85 to $100, and it's,
no.
this is all. It's the biggest stick up in boxing history, because
wow.
Believe me, in my opinion, that this fight in no way is going to come close to any of the big, exciting fights that you're used to seeing, like Hearns, Leonard, Hagler, Hearns, Duran, Leonard. You remember those fights?
Yeah.
Nowhere close to Ali Frazier, Ali Foreman. Nowhere. These fighters today don't engage like those guys did back in that era. You understand? The fighters today, they want to be, you know, they want to come in with these rappers, and, you know, they want to be pretty boys. They don't engage. The game has really, the whole paradigm in boxing has changed now. They don't really want to fight. Guys want to fight fighters who they can beat. You know, in my opinion, Mayweather was forced to fight Pacquiao, or he never would have fought him, which makes me believe, and I always thought, see, in the beginning, I always thought, and I told his uncle, I told Roger, I think that Floyd could beat Pacquiao, but for some reason, I started feeling that Floyd didn't feel that he can win, because this fight should have been made 2 or 3 years ago. When they were both at the height of their, you know, their effort. But Mayweather kept finding reasons to not fight him. So they finally, what happened, Mayweather actually ran out of opponents, because, Showtime and CBS, they started losing money on Mayweather on these pay-per-view fights. See, a lot
right,
of the
thinking,
average fan doesn't understand what's happening behind the business. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
They started losing money on Mayweather, picking and choosing, you know, cherry-picking these guys and charging $60, $70 for the fans, and the viewership was going down. So them guys,
right.
Them suits at CBS and Showtime, they backed Mayweather up and said, "Hey, man, we got to get our money back. Everybody wants to see Pacquiao. You got to fight Pacquiao." They forced him into this fight. See, and that's the part you don't know. He's forced into this fight. Now, that doesn't mean that he's not going to try to win. Okay, he's going to try to win, but that's my prediction, is that he's a very defensive fighter, Floyd Mayweather. And what happens with a lot of fighters when they're very defensive, they forget that judges don't score defense like they score offense. So when he sits back there in that pocket and showing how defensive he is, okay, something tells me he's going to get wrapped up in defense and forget to throw enough punches, and Pacquiao's going to steal those close rounds away from him. That's the way I have analyzed this thing. Now, I could be wrong, so don't bet the ranch, but I'm giving you, you know, my assessment of this. And I've been in this business a long time, so, you know, it is worth something. You know what I mean?
And you think Pacquiao is a better fighter than Mayweather?
Well, I don't necessarily think that Pacquiao is a better fighter, okay, because the better fighter doesn't always win. Strategy is what wins.
Yeah.
Okay? Strategy is mainly what wins. I don't particularly think that he's a better fighter, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that he's going to fight well enough that night to win, okay? Strategy-wise, I think that he's going to be busier. I think that he's going to be so busy enough to steal the close rounds because Floyd is a defensive fighter, and I think that Floyd is going to get wrapped up in the defense, blocking punches, slipping punches, and not really firing shots back on the counterattack. And see, judging, I know how these judges score fights. They score
right.
fights on the fighters that are aggressive. You may not, you know, it's not so much like a basketball. In a basketball game, you know, you can be a fast break team and be running up and down the court and be very aggressive, but you can be missing the shots. Okay,
exactly.
You can be missing the shots. Well, you can't win like that if you miss the shot. But in boxing, you can win being aggressive and missing if the other guy ain't doing anything. You understand what
yeah.
I'm saying?
Got
it. Because the judges are going to give you credit for, as they say, making the fight. Making
uh-huh.
the fight.
Right,
Larry,
strategist.
Larry, maybe,
that's the strategy, yes.
We could talk to you all night, but I want you to promise that right after the fight, will you come back on the show and we'll schedule you on the show?
Of course.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Are you the referee?
You just call me, you know, call me and let me know, and I'll call in. I enjoy it, yes.
Okay. Who's the referee?
I don't know. They didn't. I don't think they named the referee yet. It'll probably be either a guy named Kenny Bayless or Tony Weeks.
All right. We have about two minutes.
What was
that? We have about 2 minutes before we end the show.
No, I was going to say the fight is at Madison Square Garden, right, Mr. Hazard? Floyd and
no, that fight. The fight's in Vegas.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what I heard, yeah.
It's at the MGM in Vegas, yeah.
I thought it was at the Garden, but we're coming towards the end, like my mom was saying. Mr. Larry Hazard, Commissioner, Boxing Commissioner, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and we want to talk to you again. I want to get into other conversations with you about other great fights over history. Mm-hmm. Also want to talk to you at another time about boxing versus martial arts. And how do you see the martial arts coming, you know, UFC, a mixed martial arts game coming up and competing with straight stand-up boxing. So we want to have you back.
Okay.
We always want to have you back. Mr. Larry Hazard, Commissioner Hazard, thanks for being our guest today.
Okay, my pleasure, Eric. My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. Take care. So once again, we have come to the end of this show. Time sure flies when you're having a great conversation with a great guest. But all good things must come to an end. It has been a great night. Mr. Wayne Gilman over there holding
Thank
down
you.
In the Brooklyn studio. Excuse me.
The Bronx.
The Bronx studio. Sorry. I know y'all get testy over there. So thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you,
and
Jay.
Thank you, man.
And we'll be talking to you next week. I am Eric Payne, the son, and you are signing off.
I'm Katie Thompson. Join us again next week on Katie Thompson Live.
We're here every Wednesday at 8 to 9 p.m. live. You can call in and listen, or you can listen to the show's archived on blogtalkradio.com/Katie Thompson Live. And as always, we say, I don't know what we say always, but we play a little music, that's for sure. Watermelon Man. See you next week, people. The struggle continues.